I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority is known for helping low to moderate income home buyers as well as promoting affordable housing options. But the agency also examines major trends affecting our real estate infrastructure. And lately, what it sees is worrying. According to the authority's just released report, a mismatch is emerging between the type of housing Granite Staters need and what's available. Big houses, small households is how one of the report's authors sums it up. Driving this, a mix of demographic, economic, and cultural trends. Families getting smaller, baby boomer parents becoming empty nesters, and debt-burdened young adults either unable to afford a home or uninterested in owning one. The study also warns this housing mismatch could soon become an economic drag on our state, and it offers suggestions for a more balanced housing market, better aligned with what Granite Staters want today and will need in the future. But that's not an easy task, as builders, town planners, and lawmakers would all need to help make it happen. This hour in The Exchange, time for a real estate rethink. Let's hear from you. Are you having a hard time finding housing that fits your needs in those places that you want to live? If so, what do you see as getting in the way? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have four guests with us for the hour. Dean Kristen is here, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority, which commissioned a series of reports that I just mentioned just released today. Dean, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Paul Morin, President of Tarka Homes, actively involved with the Home Builders and Remodelers Association of New Hampshire. And Paul Morin, good to see you. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Russ Tebow, President of Applied Economic Research, an economic and real estate consulting firm in Laconia. He's co-author of the report I mentioned. And Russ, good to see you too.
Thanks. Good to be here, Laura.
And also with us, Dennis DeLay, economist at the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies, the other co-author of this three-part Housing Needs in New Hampshire, as I said, just released by the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority. And Dennis, good to see you too. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Laura. Great to be here.
Well, Dennis, that was you that I just quoted up above. Big houses, small households. That's the fundamental mismatch that we see here in the Granite State. Give us a little bit more, please.
Well, sure. What we found in the report, probably the first and most important thing, is that population growth in the state has been slowing down. We aren't seeing people move into New Hampshire at the same rate as we've seen in the past. That has a lot of other things that sort of drive the future for housing in New Hampshire, that younger buyers are challenged by slower economic growth that's associated somewhat with the migration we're talking about. Elders, seniors, are becoming a bigger and bigger part of the population. And there are different trends in different parts of the state as well. And on top of all of this, what we found in the study is that the general public, in particular the planning community and the zoning community in the local cities and towns, really doesn't seem to understand any of this and the implications that it has for New Hampshire's future and the future of housing. I want to say, just, you know, while I have the opportunity, that to thank the Housing Finance Authority for giving us the opportunity to do this work. And we did this work at the Center for Public Policy Studies in cooperation with Russ Tebow of Applied Economic Research. And it was great to be able to do that kind of work and work with Russ on the project.
Well, it'll probably spark a lot of conversation around the state because there's some real interesting stuff in here. And Russ Tebow, one of the pieces that jumps out for me is that this housing mismatch is going to be an economic drag on our state. How so?
Well, I think that what you really want in a housing market is balance. You want to have balance between growth, balance between the type of housing units and the type of households that you have. This is actually the third study that the Housing Authority has promulgated that I've had the chance to work on. And it's always been, the challenge has always been growth, accommodating growth. Now it's really a matter of accommodating change. And a lot of our zoning ordinances are growth-oriented, controlling growth, but not flexible enough to allow for the kind of changes that we're seeing. Right now, about one in five of the state's households is occupied by people age 65 and over. And just by 2025, which is only 10 years, seems like a long time away, it's going to be one out of three households in the state by these small aging boomer households who a couple of years ago, a decade ago, needed a four-bedroom house. Now maybe they only need a two-bedroom house, and most of our units are three and four bedrooms. So there's a mismatch there. And we have to have some flexibility in zoning to accommodate these new households that are coming to dominate the state's demand for housing.
And in the past, maybe, Russ, correct me if I'm wrong, that older empty nester couple would have downsized and found a smaller house, and a nice young couple with maybe a kid or two or three would have moved in, and that's how the cycle worked. But there's economic constraints, especially on this younger generation, that's not allowing them to do that.
Exactly right. I mean, one of the questions I had in my mind when we were and Dennis and I were going through the numbers was, who's going to buy all the boomers' four-bedroom houses, you know, when it's time for the boomers to downsize? Because young households, number one, there's not as many of them as there had been. Number two, they have a lot of student debt. Financing qualifications have risen. A lot of them don't want to. They want the flexibility of being able to move. Their job situation is inferior to what it was 10 or 15 years ago in the state. So the ability of boomers to downsize, as you're talking about, is challenged in part by the housing market. But also, boomers are going to be, just like everybody else, not really desiring to move into some sort of assisted living. Rather age in place, stay independent. But if you look at disability rates, you look at income constraints, you look at where they live in rural New Hampshire, where it's very hard to provide services in the home, we're going to see we're projecting a rising demand for nursing homes and assisted living facilities too.
Well, and Dean Kristen, again, this report was commissioned by your organization, the Housing Finance Authority. What's the big takeaway for you from this?
Well, I think we need to recognize all of these demographic changes and the implications that they have for the market and begin to adjust our policies to react to them. There's nothing here that is catastrophic as long as we begin rethinking a lot of the approaches we've taken to housing regulation and housing development in the past. And one of our goals here is to inform the public, because in the end, the public influences public policies. And, you know, these regulatory policies don't come from the sky. They are things that people think they need. And maybe sometimes they are misinformed or they're just not well thought out, but the public officials respond to the public. The public understands that there is, in fact, a dynamic that's changing here. Hopefully, over time, that will change some of the policies that people are talking about
okay,
here. And we'll be able to kind of weather this new storm that we're about to experience.
And, Paul, I do want to get to you, but very quickly, if you could, Dean, just a quick example of what you're talking about, adjusting policies to this new housing/demographic/economic reality.
Sure. As Russ mentioned, our regulatory policies with regard to housing are largely focused on managing growth. There was the period of high growth, high population growth, a lot of demand for housing development. People were worried about the implications on communities of that growth. We just don't see that dynamic is likely going to be the case, at least not across most of the state. And so there's a lot of policies that make it very hard to build smaller housing, to build up housing in a more compact way, because people were fearful that if they allowed that, they'd get too much of it and the impacts would be very negative. We probably need more rental housing, frankly, to go to the point. The preferences, one of the most important parts of this study was to ask people what their preferences are going to be in the future about housing. A lot of younger people are saying they want to stay in rental housing longer. They may not have a choice for economic and other reasons. And we are a state that doesn't really create a lot of rental housing. And one of the reasons we don't is because it's very hard to get rental housing approved in a lot of our communities.
Towns just don't want to build it because they perceive, correct me if I'm wrong, they perceive that it'll bring in a lot of families with a lot of kids, and
right.
then those kids will tax the school
right.
system. But
we've demonstrated time and time again, Russ has done a number of studies for us, that that's just not true. But beyond the school children issue, there's just a perception that that kind of housing doesn't fit with the rural character of communities. That's a valid concern, but it's a concern that we may need to reexamine as we face this new reality.
Well, and at this point, some communities might be happy to have school children given the aging
true.
Demographic
right.
that we're talking
yeah.
about. So, Paul, here's my question for you. The housing market is a private market that, in theory, should respond to customer demand. You know, again, this is how capitalism works. There's a demand by customers. The market meets it, and everybody walks away fine. So why isn't that happening now?
Well, I think that home builders are responding to the demand when we see a marked change in what people are asking us for, that there's far fewer younger home buyers, and there are very many senior or soon-to-be seniors wanting to downsize, looking for single-level living. We're very happy to provide it. But as several of the guests have pointed out already, there are certain regulatory barriers. It may be municipal zoning laws. It may be just finding land that is affordable enough to put a smaller unit on and still meet an appraisal for financing purposes, because if lots are large and expensive, you can put a smaller home, but the overall cost is still perhaps unaffordable for a lot of these folks. We also are looking to people who want to combine households. I'm getting a lot of requests for in-laws, more than I've ever had in my career. And it's not in-laws are not just for in-laws anymore. They could be a college graduate or a young couple that the parents are trying to give a leg up to, or a single mom or something like that. We have zoning barriers that creating this type of housing or remodeling for this type of housing is difficult at times.
Wow. So let's say that a baby boomer couple wants to bring an aging parent into the house, or a baby boomer couple has a daughter who's, you know, maybe gotten a divorce and needs time to get back on her feet and needs to move in with her child or two. You're saying it's hard to construct housing to fit that need.
It can be. There are zoning restrictions that say that the occupant of the accessory unit must be a member of the household, must be a family member, or you may not rent this space should it become unoccupied, or it may not be more than 750 square feet, or it may not have its own separate entry visible from the street. And all these unusual restrictions on how you can create such, and some towns don't even address it on the books. So you don't even know what you can build.
Do you want to jump in there, Russ?
Yeah, I was just going to say your point about supply and demand. I mean, we do have a housing market. It's so supply and demand should balance each other out. The problem is that you've got very dynamic demand, meaning these demographics that we've talked about, young people at both ends of the age spectrum, fairly dramatic changes going on. But we've got a static supply. There's 450,000 housing units in the state. So the supply is kind of fixed. You could say we're stuck with what we have. And in any given year, we only build about 2,000 to 4,000 units. So we have to think about adapting what we have to the new demographics of the state.
Well, that's a good point. And housing is a lot more fixed than, you know, changing the offerings at the grocery store.
Right. The supply is very fixed.
All right. We will talk a lot more in just a moment. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR reaches listeners all over New Hampshire. If you own or operate a business, you can get your message to the entire state by simply becoming an NHPR underwriter. Visit the support page at nhpr.org to find out more about our many underwriting opportunities. More on housing mismatch misgivings on The Exchange, and then a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, using blood tests to diagnose and treat disease. New Hampshire weather, mix of sun and clouds today, highs from around 40 in northern Coos County, mid-40s to lower 50s in the rest of the state. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the Wealth Management Group at Merrimack County Savings Bank. Trust and wealth management services provided by advisors committed to your financial needs, themerrimack.com. And the Woodstock Inn, Station, and Brewery, brewing handcrafted ale since 1994, offering its seasonal maple porter. Made with local maple syrup, WoodstockInBrewery.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, an emerging housing mismatch in the Granite State. A brand new report finds that with shifting New Hampshire demographics, household incomes, and lifestyle preferences, our housing stock soon won't fit us anymore. And it predicts that this infrastructure mismatch could be a drag on future economic growth. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Are you having a hard time finding housing that fits your needs, fits your budget in those places that you want to live? If so, what do you see as getting in the way? Do you see this housing mismatch that our guests talk about, or not? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests are Dean Kristen with the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority, which commissioned the study. Co-authors Dennis DeLay and Russ Tebow are also here, along with Paul Morin, president of Tarka Homes. He's actively involved with the Home Builders and Remodelers Association of New Hampshire. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Dean, let's pick up on what Russ said just before the break. I thought it was really interesting. You know, it's one thing to have other economic goods, supply and demand. Supposedly, suppliers can shift pretty quickly to emerging customer demand. But with housing, Russ pointed out, not so easy.
Well, it goes to the regulatory dynamics that we've been talking about. You can't decide to do whatever you want to do with a property in the context of housing regulation. So you could have perhaps homes that are too big, as Russ pointed out earlier, in many places now, for what the population needs. What we need instead perhaps is to take that housing, turn it into multiple units. It's not that simple in a lot of places. Some places will support that. Some communities, a lot, just don't. They just don't support the idea of turning a property into multi-units. And that makes the market not this sort of free market that you're talking about that will simply react to market demand simply. One of the purposes of doing this kind of work is to begin to inform people so that they become willing to perhaps consider changing those kinds of policies to support a dynamic market environment and support the needs of a new marketplace.
So, for example, let's say you've got a baby boomer couple, their kids are gone. I live in the neighborhood of UNH Law, which is growing. Mm-hmm. So let's say I wanted to change my structure a little bit and rent out to some UNH Law students. Easier said than done.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, some communities will allow you to do that. Some won't. Some, as Paul says, will have lots of restrictions that focus on the idea of accessory dwelling units that were designed, what people used to call in-law apartments. But they don't let you do it if you're going to rent to a student or something like that. They just and again, a lot of this stuff is based on real concerns, but they are concerns that perhaps need to be reevaluated and processes need to be undertaken to modify and improve those approaches.
Okay, and Paul, you're in the trenches with all this.
Oh, absolutely. And we get a lot of calls to remodel existing housing stock to meet the changing needs of folks. We can take a single-family home that is large and create a duplex or a multifamily unit as long as the underlying zoning allows for such things. People want lower cost to maintain their homes, and so we'll do weatherization and drop their energy bills. They want lower maintenance as people are aging in place. Part of the thing is accessibility. Part of it is maintenance. We can make hallways wider, and we can lower countertops and all of these things so that people can remain in their homes that much longer.
And that is one of the themes of this report as well that's so interesting, Dennis DeLay, that the future perhaps for New Hampshire housing is in this remodeling that Paul's talking about.
Exactly right. And, you know, it's interesting, though, that I think, as Dean was talking about a few minutes ago, what seems to be standing in the way is existing regulation. One of the things we heard in the focus groups that stuck with me was, you know, if you look at the local planning or zoning process, you know, there are rules that are set up, and it's very difficult, frankly, for people at the local level in the zoning boards or the planning boards to make exceptions to the rules, you know. And there seems to be this fear that, you know, if you make an exception and it doesn't go very well, well, then it becomes Joe Smith's boondoggle, and that, you know,
that doesn't look good.
That's around long after Joe Smith leaves the planning board.
So that's a problem.
That's a problem.
What else did you hear, Russ, in the focus groups from folks on the younger end? Let's focus on that group because there's some real interesting economic but also cultural dynamics that are at play here.
That was probably the most interesting focus group we had. It was the most revealing to me. The young people, there's a tremendous diversity in the way they meet their housing needs. It's not a matter of just grabbing an apartment when you get out of school staying with that until you
saving up some money.
Saving up some money, maybe getting married, having a kid, and then buying a single family. That kind of model, that transitional model that was the rule when I was young, isn't there anymore. You have young people that own a house that are renting to other young people. You have young people that are living with their parents still. You have young people that want to live in a very rural setting but have an urban job, so they're commuting great distances. So there's what struck me about that focus group was the tremendous diversity in the way young people are meeting their housing needs. And part of it's driven by the job market, much more difficult to get, you know, a full-time breadwinner job than it used to be. Part of it is partnering up maybe a little later, getting married later. And part of it is insecurity about the housing market. If I buy a house now, will I lose money on it, which was never in my mind when I was young.
Well, sure, but they saw what happened in the mid-2000s,
exactly.
And who can blame them?
So, I think that segment of the housing market is just very diverse in the kind of housing that they prefer and the kind of housing they're going after, much more so than was the case before and much more so than other demographic groups.
And maybe, Dean, you know, that home ownership isn't an American dream for a lot of these younger adults.
Well, I do think there's a little bit of a cultural thing going on here that we kind of sensed before we actually asked folks to do this study, which is why we wanted to do these focus groups, that it may or may not be that people don't want to be homeowners per se, but that there is a sense that they have a different perspective on it. It's not you move immediately into the 3 or 4 bedroom house on the 2-acre lot, and there's less, I think, interest perhaps in traditional rural and suburban environments. People want the idea of being in a more urban setting. And there's not necessarily the opportunity to be a homeowner in that setting as easily in our state as there is in some other environments. And I think that has some long-term implications for population growth and potential economic activity in our state as well, unless we adjust to those different cultural
Just
changes
really
too.
Really quickly, I have 4 sons, and my youngest one told me a couple of weeks ago, you know, Dad, I'll never be able to buy a house. And I think that's
here you are, a housing economist.
Yeah, I know. but in contrast, his other 3 brothers already own a house. But his feeling is it's just out of reach for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's not impossible to reconfigure the existing housing stock. I mean, we've done it before. If you look at a lot of the larger houses in the downtown Concord and downtown Manchester, downtown Nashua, you see these big homes that have been converted.
When people had 8 kids.
Yeah,
right.
Where people had 8 kids, and that was where the mill owner lived, and now it's a doctor's office or a real estate firm or whatever. The problem is a lot of those big houses now are out in cul-de-sacs in Amherst and Bedford, and you have to think about, are we going to be able to convert those in the same way that we were able to convert homes in the center of the cities.
Sure. So in town, you can make, I have some friends, for example, one half of this big house is their office. And
right.
There's a couple professionals, 4 or 5 professionals. And then the other half is their home. And it's actually relatively small, but it's fine. It's just the two of them. Easier to do that in town, Dennis, than perhaps out in the burbs.
And then you start to run into transportation issues, especially
right.
for the senior population, the elder population.
Yeah. Russ, real quick, and then I want to go to our listeners.
There is a model out there that's interesting. There's about 135,000 households in the state, that's a big number, that have only one person in them, only one person occupying the housing unit. And the model I'm thinking of is has surfaced in Durham, and it's actually right now for student housing. And it's 4 bedrooms, 4 bathrooms, 1 living room, 1 kitchen. Individuals that are unrelated share the common areas. And actually, it's very economic to build, and it's very adapted to the needs. But in a lot of communities, as Dean has pointed out, you couldn't build these units. But it's a model that could work for a broader spectrum of the housing market.
I think the message there is flexibility,
right.
And that's really the core issue. We need to have more flexibility in the way that we approach housing regulation and development as we go forward, given the changes in the market.
Our phone number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Your thoughts, observations, personal experiences with this housing mismatch that our guests are outlining for us, 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And a couple of emails that have just come in. Paul, I'll throw this one to you. This is Tom in Rye. He says, your panel just touched on multi-generational housing and some of the limitations. Are there any New Hampshire communities that are more forward-looking in trying to accommodate multi-generational arrangements? Tom says, due to broader economic forces, we are likely to see a growing need in this area. Thanks, Tom, for the email.
Yes, so there are some communities that are responding. They're either taking older ordinances off of the books or they're simply taking a creative approach to what it is they allow us to do. It takes time when you're talking about ordinances that are voted in at town meeting or by town council, and so it may take a few years. And really, it's incumbent upon builders and developers to bring the message to these towns that they need to change these models so that we're allowed to build these things, because the demand is clear.
You know, Russ also mentioned transportation, and that's something that jumped out at me from the study as well, that a lot of younger people and increasingly older people, Paul, are going to want to settle in those communities that have transportation. So that's good news for maybe Durham, maybe Portsmouth, maybe Concord, Manchester, but less good news for suburban communities.
It is good news. I have a growing concern about affordability. I mean, we've been talking about affordability gap ever since the housing crash. But if we're talking about smaller units now, and unless we are increasing density or downsizing lots as well as downsizing the homes, when the appraisals come in, there's a gap there. They're not necessarily appraising for full value. And given what has happened to a lot of homeowners in the last 5-6 years, there is a reluctance to bring extra cash to the table and start with a lower equity position in these homes. People
are
smarter about
that. I'm sorry. I'm not quite following what you're saying. I'm not real good at housing finance economics.
When you're creating new housing stock, some people can come in and purchase it, and it's at full value for, you know, if they were to resell it in a year. But if you start out having to bring extra money to the table because it just doesn't have market value, it costs too much to build, you have to wait for a while before that value catches up for the market to come back. And people are less they're more reluctant because they just don't see the investment value given what's happened in the last 6 years.
You're talking from a builder perspective.
A builder perspective.
I see.
So even though there's fewer buyers, but they're also wary.
Do you want to jump in there, Dean, and we'll go back to our listeners?
Well, I think part of what Paul's pointing out as well is that if you require somebody to have an acre of land or 2 acres of land for a relatively small house, and you have other density requirements and other kinds of requirements that drive up the cost of producing that smaller, quote-unquote, less expensive housing unit, it creates this mismatch between value and cost of production, and it makes it difficult for the market to produce that kind of housing.
I see. Can say, why aren't you building these houses? And Paul's saying, because you still have to make a profit. You're in business.
Absolutely. And it's also true of other kinds of housing, whether they be condominiums or apartments or whatever. If you make it difficult to build enough volume, if you will, enough density in order to get the cost down, the market can't do it. It just can't make it happen.
All right. Well, Tom, thanks for the email. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Kate's joining us from Manchester. Hi, Kate. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I'm in a relationship. We're a couple in our early 30s and professional. And one of the struggles we have really had in our demographic, both ourselves and our friends, is finding housing that allows for pets, primarily dogs, especially given that we're choosing either to not have children at all or until more in our late 30s. And so we have a dog because we don't have a baby. So finding housing that allows for that, that isn't something requiring a very high income or home ownership, is difficult.
So you're in rental, Kate?
Yes, we're in rental.
Yeah, and having a hard time finding a landlord who will let you have a dog. We talked a little bit earlier about, you know, younger adults not wanting to own a home or not feeling they can afford it. Which category do you fall in? Do you feel like you can't afford it, or do you feel like you're just not interested in all the responsibility?
Right now, we're trying to save up so that we could get to a place where we own a home that's a little bit larger and a little bit of a longer-term home rather than a very small starter home.
So like to own a home, but feel like you can't afford one right now.
Right.
Okay.
Well, we're working on it.
Yeah. Well, good luck to you, Kate. And with the
you.
Dog, Russ, real quick, and I have a question for you too, Dennis.
Okay. I think part of Kate's problem is a problem market-wide, which is that the rental inventory right now is very tight. Mm-hmm. So landlords don't have to accept pets. Landlords can require, 1 month in advance plus a security deposit. So our rental market is tight and expensive. So maybe at some point it shifts back over towards the ownership side, whereas ownership housing is less expensive than it was in 2006. Rental housing is more expensive. We have a lot of vacancy still in ownership housing, but almost none in rentals. So Kate's caught between a rock and a hard place.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I thought Kate said something interesting, too, about that she wanted to go a little bit, she and her significant other wanted to go a little bit beyond a starter home for their first home. They wanted to get something that was a little bit bigger, and they were trying to save up for that. One of the other things we found in the study is that, you know, there's a difficulty for renters to do that because if you look at the trends in renter income versus owner, household owner income, the income for people that traditionally rent hasn't been increasing as fast as it has for people that already own a home. And that gets into whole other issues about job quality and other things. But again, that's another barrier in the way. It makes it more difficult to get the first-time home buyer into the market if they're not making the income so that they can save up to buy that property.
Here's an email from someone also on this issue. Thanks for the call, Kate, by the way. Janet in Portsmouth says, I'm a realtor serving Seacoast, New Hampshire, and Southern Maine. One of the problems I see with our housing market is the lack of savings from the first-time home buyers. They have good income, but no savings. Janet says, if they could save 3.5% for a down payment, that would qualify them for an FHA loan and open up a whole lot of inventory for them to choose from. This is a big issue in the report, Dean. Savings, income among that population, but also lending practices.
Right. Well, one of the issues is that what Russ and Dennis have already pointed to, which is that the cost of rental housing relative to incomes of the population that is likely to be a first-time buyer is very high. I mean, we think of housing as having gotten very affordable because of the housing recession, but the fact is rental housing has continued to become more expensive rather than less.
So it's eating up a bigger chunk of people's incomes.
It does. And so it makes it harder for people to pay for their lives and have a place to live and also save money in the context the realtor spoke about. Anyway, there are programs. We have some. Others have them that provide assistance to people with down payment and closing cost assistance. And it is true that a relatively small down payment can get someone into a home if they otherwise qualify. But there are other impediments that also exist for a lot of young people, one of the most significant ones being student debt. We have across the country, this is a significant problem. In New Hampshire, we have, as I think the report notes, the highest average level of student debt for young folks coming into the market. And the way the economy has changed, and I know you've had a couple of shows on this, as the regulatory environment has changed in the mortgage market, it has become more difficult for people who have that kind of debt to qualify for a mortgage. So that's another factor that's going to limit the ability of young home buyers to enter the market in the way that traditionally they did and will have an effect on the overall dynamics of our market.
Paul, jump in, please.
I'm finding a similar problem with folks who have large homes. They need to sell, and they want to downsize. And trying to meet their financial goals, they're finding they don't have the equity that they thought they had. It's clearly a buyer's market for these very large homes that are out there. And so they may be able to afford it, but it is not a smart retirement plan for them. They are really looking to use the equity from their existing home, and they're finding that very difficult.
So that's a psychological barrier, too. I paid $400,000 10 years ago, and now you're telling me it's only worth $300,000? You know, I'm going to hang on to it.
It doesn't make financial sense to them.
All right. Well, thank you again for that call. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment. 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, using blood tests to diagnose and treat disease. Then one man searched to understand his grandfather's attempt to escape the Holocaust. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners. And support also comes to us from Edward Jones, a financial services firm serving individuals and business owners. Edward Jones, Making Sense of Investing, a member of SIPC. And from Home Healthcare, Hospice and Community Services, providing hospice volunteer training programs in Charlestown and Hillsborough. Information at hcsservices.org. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at an emerging housing mismatch in the Granite State. A new report from the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority says not too far down the road, New Hampshire's housing infrastructure won't fit New Hampshire's demographic, economic, and cultural needs, needs that are changing as we're hearing this hour. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Here's an email, gentlemen, that just came in from Jen in the Seacoast area. She says the single biggest deciding factor for us when it comes to buying a home is the rate of property taxes in New Hampshire. As it stands now, when my husband's daughter is old enough and she graduates, we are leaving the state. My personal opinion, Jen says, is that the state of New Hampshire needs to add a state sales tax. This burden needs to be removed from the residents. However, no one wants to discuss this. It's the elephant in the room. Well, Russ Tebow, property taxes, you know, that's always a factor that you have to look at when you're buying a house and think about how much you need to shell out every month.
At the focus group, we did have a focus group with seniors. And then looking at some of the data, what struck me was seniors that have no mortgage on their house, there's still a relatively high proportion of them that are paying more than the standard amount that you would expect of their income for housing. And part of the reason is because of property taxes. I mean, if you're a typical Social Security recipient, you might get $12,000, maybe $18,000 a year in income. Property taxes on a $200,000 home, which is about the typical home in New Hampshire, can run you $4,000. So nearly a quarter of your income is being absorbed by property taxes. So for some segments of the market, I think particularly the older, elderly part of the market, and probably also is going back to what Dean said, high property taxes make it more difficult to qualify for a mortgage as well, because that's taken into account in your ability to pay. So across the board, but particularly I think for seniors and for young households, property taxes are a major issue in the market.
All right. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Thanks for that one. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's another email that came in. This is from Gary in Sugar Hill. He says, I read an article about re-urbing America, where mixed zoning is encouraged, i.e. light industry, retail, housing are integrated rather than segregated. What most towns do today. This creates, he says, a more walkable community, reduces our carbon footprint, and encourages community for young and old. And this is something, Dean, that people have been talking about for a long time, but now maybe there's more pressure to do this.
Right. I mean, one of the observations that I think a lot of folks have made over the years is that a lot of what we love about New England and in the rural context is the village dynamic of a lot of our older communities. And that village dynamic where you mixed some sort of commercial and other use along with housing in relative close proximity is exactly what we don't allow in most of those communities anymore. We say that's what we love. That's what we love about our rural character of our communities. And then we basically force people to put the housing all in one place and the commercial stuff in another place. You can't walk to them. You can't interact with them. And it does. As you get an older population that wants to be able to walk, you get younger people that want to be able to walk. Those younger folks want to take their dogs for a walk and go buy something somewhere or go get a cup of coffee somewhere. And they can't do that if they're on a cul-de-sac in a traditional suburban environment miles away from the nearest commercial location.
Well, this gets to something we touched on earlier, but Dennis, again, as we look at this mismatch and possible economic drag on the state, again, it's good news for Hanover, Concord, Keene, you know, mm-hmm. sort of walkable communities with a good amount of housing stock right close to downtown.
Right. Well, and I think the other thing we found in the focus groups, and if you can see it in the data as well, is it's not just the larger cities. It's also the areas of New Hampshire that are closer to the transportation network. One of the folks in one of the focus groups told us, you know, if you look along I-93 or I-89, housing markets there are fairly buoyant and fairly successful. But you go two towns over and all of a sudden there's nothing going on. And those are, in particular, that's a very different pattern than what we saw in the last 20 or so years, where we saw not only development along I-93 and 89, but also this filling in the center part of the state between the seacoast and the Manchester area. We had a lot of growth in the Durham area and places like that. That is not happening any longer. And what we're starting to see there in particular there are the declining school populations and maybe, hopefully, I hope this doesn't happen, but a kind of non-virtuous circle of rising property taxes as you're trying to support the infrastructure that you already have, which causes more people to think about moving out, as one of the callers said.
All right, let's take another caller. This is Sharon in West Rumney. Sharon, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Go ahead.
Well, what I wanted to say is that the description, I really resonate with everything that you're saying. And additionally, I would like to supply the perspective of the homeowner, not just the home seeker, the would-be buyer, but the homeowner who is in place has a very hard time. I bought a lot with a small cottage on it, and then I built a garage to enhance the value of the property so that when I sell it, I could get more than when I bought it, right? And behind the garage, I added a little living unit, very tiny. And then I went to rent that out along with the cottage, and I was told that I can't do that. In fact, I'm not even supposed to be living here myself.
Wow.
The second dwelling, they call it, is simply out of the – not allowed, period.
So this was a little dwelling?
If it was attached to the first house, it could still be disallowed because then you have two kitchens and two bathrooms, and that's – well, two bathrooms might be allowed, but two kitchens are not allowed. Then it's considered two dwellings. But it's a, you know, it's a ways from the other house, so it's perfect for a, like an in-law or an older teen or a kid, you know, who graduated already but needs a place to live and doesn't really want to live with his parents.
But kind of needs a little help. Yeah, so lots of demographics, Paul. This is right up your alley, isn't it? Who might be able to use that little, what we used to call a mother-in-law apartment.
Sharon's describing a situation that sounds would work very well for her, and it's really puzzling to figure out why we don't allow or why we're concerned about such things, why she would have to go through an elaborate process to ask for some special exception to be allowed to do something that evolves very naturally as we live on land and our life changes and we find that things make sense to us. It sounds like a perfectly natural situation for her to fall into, but zoning doesn't allow it.
What do you think, Dennis? Are we going to see more people trying to build mother-in-law apartments? What do you call them? Boomerang children who sort of have left the nest but then need to come back for various reasons?
Yeah, I think we will. I mean, the demographic data certainly indicates that. As Russ said at the top of the hour, we're going to – about a third of the people in homes in New Hampshire in the next 15 years are going to be over the age of 65. Now, they'll probably want to stay for the most part where they are. But as you sort of think about the existing, you know, quintessential New Hampshire house right now, you know, two floors and a kitchen that maybe doesn't meet the needs of more senior people, we're going to have to figure out how to change that living environment for folks that are just moving into their elder years.
Well, and Russ, let's get the other side too, though. I mean, we have talked a lot this hour about, you know, demographics are changing, economics are changing. Planners need to change the way they think to accommodate people like our caller, like some of the younger people that we've talked to. But there must be reasons for these rules and regulations. Communities don't want just growth and building willy-nilly so that they don't look nice.
Yeah, I think Dean pointed it out that there was a time when it was appropriate to be very concerned about growth and overwhelming your community. There might have been a community next door to yours that had a 50-unit condominium project. You don't want that. Doesn't fit your community. So I think the regulations are regulations for a New Hampshire that doesn't exist anymore, a fast-growing, prosperous New Hampshire. We now have a slow-growing, economically challenged New Hampshire, and I think our regulatory framework has to adapt to that.
All right, let's take another call. This is Lisa waiting in Hollis. Hi, Lisa, you're on the Exchange. Thanks for calling in. Lisa, you're on the air. Go ahead. Love to hear from you. Okay, Lisa, I hope you call back. The number for Lisa and others to call in is 1-800-892-6477. Susie in Dunbarton is with us. Hi, Susie, you're on the Exchange.
Hi, thank you.
Sure, go ahead, Susie.
I'm 20. I have a daughter who's 5 months old, and my boyfriend and I are unable to afford a place to stay by ourselves. So we're trying to find a place to rent with our friends who are also 20, 21, and I feel like we're getting a lot of discrimination against our age. I feel like people think that they're going to be renting like a frat house or something, and like it's really, really hard and challenging to find a place for us to stay.
When you sort of explain your situation, and you're talking rental, Susie, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What do you think, Dean? You know, she's just trying to make it work.
Well, that's true, and it's a challenge, and I appreciate that. You know, property owners obviously have a need to be concerned about the dynamics of who they're going to rent to. And there are people that are uneasy about renting to groups of unrelated young people. They're worried that it is, in fact, what I think the term she used, the frat house. I mean, that may not be what they are or what they would do or the way they would behave, but people get nervous about that. And you can see that in some environments where there are a lot of college students, for instance, who rent properties together. There can be damage to units. There can be issues associated with that. Some property owners are prepared to deal with that. Some are not. And so in the environment she's in and the community she's looking in, this may be unique. It may not be a common practice. They may have to go into, frankly, a more urban environment where there's a little more use. People are a little more used to dealing with that kind of household.
Well, and Susie, good luck to you. And I remember, Dean, living in D.C. for as many years as I did, that often my housing situation was what everybody called a group house, and it would be two, three, four, five young people renting one big house. So everybody had their own bedroom, and then you'd share bath and share kitchen, and it was lovely. You always had somebody to talk to.
Well, I think as Russ points out, there's some of that going on now in the sense that some young people who can't find other alternatives are maybe acquiring a house and then renting out units. And they may not be doing it, quite frankly, in a very formal way, and it may or may not even be legal under the regulatory environment of whatever community they're in. They're just doing it because that's the only way that they can make the numbers work.
You know, everything that we do touches on everything else, you know, and I know we've talked, you've had other guests on the show talking about the desire to retain young people in New Hampshire, to keep them here. Housing, as we just heard in the last caller, affects that. Again, in the Young Professionals Housing Group that Russ and I chaired, that was the last group that we did, one of the members of the group looked at us and said, you know, New Hampshire says they want to keep young professionals here. Why are they making it so hard for us to stay?
For people like Lisa.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for the call again. Did you want to jump in, Paul?
Yeah, Susie lives in Dunbarton, not known for its rental units, but there are many homes in Dunbarton that could be easily repurposed to allow this sort of rental situation, and it's not chewing up any new land, so it really is good for conservation of land. And the question is, why not? We have to change our thinking on these things.
You know, just going to the two calls, it was Susie and I think it was the woman from West Rumney.
Sharon. Have
a woman in West Rumney that has a unit that she'd like to rent out in a rural setting, and you have a household. I know that it's not the same setting, but a household looking in a rural setting, and it says there's something wrong here. Here's some housing supply that you can do in a rural setting, and here's the demand for rental housing, small rental unit. It sounds like Susie would be ideal to rent that unit in West Rumney.
Except they're miles, miles apart. But I get your
point.
No,
but I'm just talking generically
right.
Speaking, that you can allow rental housing in a rural setting without disrupting the community. And in doing so, you can accommodate young households, the kind of households, as Dennis says, we want to keep in the state. It
I
can
see
be
what
done.
You're saying. You're saying that rural communities who want to keep that beautiful character don't necessarily need to fear that rental housing means building, you know, a skyscraper with 200 apartments.
Exactly, yeah. Thank
that
you.
There's a way to accommodate that.
Yeah.
All right, well, good luck to her again. The number 1-800-892-6477. Another caller from Dunbarton. This is Phil. Hi, Phil. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I wanted to say many of the issues that you're identifying that you've been talking about in a rural context also apply in the downtown. For example, we own some mixed-use properties in downtown Nashua with stores below and apartments above, and we're fortunate in that it's grandfathered in. But in many places, that kind of mixed use, while desirable, doesn't happen because even in older buildings, they may have been repurposed for offices, and now that there's frankly no demand for offices, they can't be brought back to residences. You walk through downtown Concord, you can see upstairs in many of the downtown buildings are just empty. That's wrong.
Phil, that's a great point. Can you jump in on that, Paul, real quickly, that people might want to live downtown, but the upper floors aren't purposed for that?
Yes, the days where people want to drive 30, 45 minutes to an hour to work, at least as what they tell me on my phone, they're over. And to be able to live and work in one location, absolutely. And again, to take these buildings and repurpose them is the easy part.
Let's take one more call if we could. We have just about a minute left, but I would like to get Scott in Manchester on the air. Hi, Scott. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Hi, good morning. I own a house in Manchester, and I have actually moved to Bedford and leased a condo because of the school situation. And I think a lot of these towns and cities, if they work on the infrastructure, would find people more willing to move and to live there. Your caller that was said she was 21 and she had her husband and her baby and a group of people, I recently put my house on the market to be leased because it cannot sell. And have found that there's a lot of people out there looking that might not have the financial means to afford $2,000 a month or $1,800 a month for a large house. You know, that's difficult for me because I have a family of my own. I'm paying lease on another housing unit in Bedford and own the house in Manchester. So that puts a burden on my family, and I need to not put my family at risk.
Sure, you need to recoup that as well. Yeah,
that's right. I'm not a slumlord or someone who owns multiple properties and is just generating cash month after month. I work for a living.
Well, and Scott, I got to let you go because we're running out to the end of the hour. But Dean, here's another mismatch. He doesn't want to overcharge people, but he needs to at least break even.
Absolutely. But again, I mean, if we look at this, I think the word or flexibility is the word that we need to keep in mind. If you look at this as an opportunity to take that home and perhaps repurpose it into two units or something of that nature so that you then find two people that can afford to pay what he needs in order to support the property, but at the same time you're housing those two different households. And it's just not something that we're comfortable with as much as we need to be.
Well, Scott, thank you for the call. And Dean, just very quickly, so this is a series of three reports that the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority has commissioned. The first one's out today.
That's correct.
And then the next two are in the coming weeks.
Absolutely. And we're hopeful that they all sort of inform the public and help get stimulate this debate and dialogue and eventually will help us all kind of grapple with these issues better.
All right. Well, you can find the report on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Check it out. Thank you all very much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Knoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, adapting to climate change with new dire predictions about a warming planet at the international level, two New Hampshire researchers focus on how our cities and towns will need to adjust to this new reality. We'll look at their work, plus we talk to an Associated Press reporter on the rising costs and controversy over flood insurance. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners. And support also comes to us from Dartmouth Hitchcock, primary care doctors and nurses will put you at the center of health, 13 locations statewide. Information at the-hdocs.org. And Landmark College, Putney, Vermont, offering a summer institute for education professionals, working with students who learn differently, June 24th to 27th. Information at landmark.edu.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua
88.3. WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Blood tests have long been a routine part of medicine. Complete blood counts, red and white cell counts, blood chemistry, and a number of other tests give doctors valuable information about a patient's health. But researchers are discovering blood tests may also offer